Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined, as usual, by Lahav Harkov, our diplomatic correspondent. And today, Lahav, we're recording just hours away from Prime Minister Yair Lapid's speech at the United Nations General Assembly. He's been in New York for the last couple of days, holding a bunch of meetings. He met with the Turkish President Erdogan, King Abdullah of Jordan, the new British Prime Minister Liz Truss. Lots to talk about there. But what's really been making headlines back here in Israel is the fact that Yair Lapid, as Prime Minister, plans to stand at the podium with that green wall, I guess, at the General Assembly behind him and declare that Israel supports a two-state solution. Oh my God.
Breaking news.
Breaking news, right?
Yeah, Lapid supports a two-state solution.
And people are going crazy. Bennett, his partner, is going off the wall. I mean, Likud is out on the attack. What is going on here?
Leave aside the fact, like, whether you, the listener, support two-state solution or not, because it's a legitimate argument, and I think there are strong arguments on both sides. But it's just should not be a surprise to anyone that Yair Lapid supports a two-state solution. He always has, not even from day one in politics, but, like, you know, for decades before that, he wrote a weekly newspaper column and he supported a two-state solution. So, like, it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. And then there's also the fact that Netanyahu talked about a two-state solution many times on the stage of the UN. You know, and one could argue that he sort of did that to get people off of his back while he never actually did anything to promote a two-state solution. But frankly, you could say the same thing about Lapid too. Like, what is he doing, right? Like, who's bringing, what exactly has his government been doing to make a two-state solution happen? And not that he's had a lot of time. The uproar seems a little crazy to me. The person who I think, like, his comments made the most sense to me was Bennett, because Bennett's argument is that if we don't talk about the Palestinians so much, then the world won't talk to us about the Palestinians so much, which is an idea that I would say has had mixed results. But certainly Bennett, I mean, when he was up on stage, he focused on, you know, Israel and technology almost entirely.
No, Bennett's whole policy over the years has been just don't talk to me about it, right? I mean,
right.
The land belongs to the Jews. The Palestinians are here. We have to somehow figure things out, but don't bother me. I don't want to talk about it. Like, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, pretend it doesn't exist. Now, that doesn't really work long term. That's not a sustainable approach that can resolve a conflict that still exists and is Israel's conflict, right? We can't pretend that we don't have a conflict. We do have a conflict. But the issue here that I found to be just almost laughable was everyone's going after Lapid. So, like you said, Lapid's known to be a supporter of the two-state solution. He's going to declare his support for a two-state solution. Bibi himself from the UN podium, and I was watching a video yesterday from 2016 where he openly said, and I support the two states for two people. He had the famous Bar-Ilan speech. In his final months in office, he openly supported the Trump plan, which was basically also a two-state plan. So Olmert supported two states. Ariel Sharon supported two states. Ehud Barak supported two states. Why are we so bent out of shape here? I mean, that's the question I wonder, is like, why is this? Are we bored? Do we not have what to talk about as in our political discussions? Like, where is this all coming from?
I think that the non-Likud right is in crisis right now, and they're having, like, an identity crisis. And you have all of these people who, you know, Gideon Saar and Matan Kahana, for example, who are running on Benny Gantz's list. And I don't think anyone has any doubt that Gantz supports a two-state solution, even if he's a little bit more circumspect than Lapid about it.
Yeah, you remember what Gantz called it, the two-entity solution? Right. He couldn't say states, so he called it the two entities.
Right. But if you look in the archives, he's also talked about two states.
Of course he's a two-state. No, yes. So the entities, yeah. That's just a game of semantics, right? Of course
exactly.
He's a two-stater.
Exactly. So then you have these people who are, you know, at least when they entered politics, but Gideon Saar has been in politics for more than 20 years, you know, solidly right wing against conceding any land to the Palestinians, but they're running under someone who is for conceding land to the Palestinians, and somehow they need to like bolster their right wing bona fide. So like, here's their opportunity, because now people are talking about two state solution. So they're going to chime in and say, oh, by the way, don't forget us. We're really right wing.
These are games. This is all games. And you know what it is? It's a game for by people who unfortunately trying to just not have to talk about anything of real substance in these elections. And that's what it is. And sadly, we fall for it. We being the people of Israel.
I mean, I think the two-state solution is real substance, but like, let's have a real conversation about it and not about Lapid's speech in the UN.
Right, well,
like, okay, 100%. What are they offering? What are their alternatives? And why are they running in a party that doesn't actually believe what they believe? I mean, I think I talked about it before when it, like, right after it happened, but I was pretty shocked when Saar ran with Gantz, because it just doesn't make any sense to me. And these are, like, basically these parties, these blocks, like, exist only because they want to stay in the Knesset, not because they have anything to say together.
By the way, speaking of Gideon Saar, he was once touted as like a future prime minister, and look at him now. He's number two to a left winger, right? I mean, like, you know, he was supposed to be this right wing guy coming out of Likud, and he is a genuine right winger, but now he sits number two in a party that's led by Benny Gantz, who is, I think, I mean, there's nothing wrong with saying that I think he's genuinely on the left, right? And that's the reality. You know what's crazy, though,
Laha? Moderate left, like, you know, the... There used to be labor hawks and labor doves. Today, there are only labor doves. So Gantz is the labor hawk outside of labor.
By the way, also this whole right-left conversation that we often have, like who's on the right, who's on the left. What's the difference really between the right and the left? I mean, it's hard to find.
Well, in Gantz's case, I think that he's left economically also. Like he's very, very pro-union.
Right. Okay. That's something. Right. But when it comes to like the past, like when we used to have conversations of land for peace, right? Those conversations don't really exist anymore. And even those on the left, the so-called left, who would want to do more to advance a two-state solution, they're not looking to pull out a 97% of the West Bank like, you know, back in the days of Ehud Olmert or Ehud Barak at Camp David. Like those offers aren't on the table. They're not coming back onto the table.
No, and you don't hear Lapid talk about land for peace either. He talks about like separation. We need less of a headache. We don't need to be responsible for the Palestinians anymore.
But it raises a different question, I feel, to an extent, which is, what are these elections about? This is the fifth one. What are the four ones before that? And when was the last time we actually had an election that was about policy? And unfortunately, tough to recall, right? Because all these elections are yes, Bibi, no, Bibi. We want Bibi. We don't want Bibi. We're going to work with Bibi. We're not going to sit with Bibi. It's really become sad. And I think it genuinely deteriorates not just the political conversation in this country, but just the general feeling, I feel, to an extent within society right now.
So let's talk about low-level political communication in the form of Eretz Nehadaret. Eretz Nehadaret is, and I hesitate to flatter it in this way, but I don't have a better comparison. It's sort of like Israel's Saturday Night Live, for those who are not familiar. Right. That's why I say I hesitate to flatter it. But it has... instead of just having like weekend update be this little segment in the middle, the entire structure is like a newscast. And before they always have like a season before the election. So they've been very active lately. And it's been going on for, I don't know, like 20 years or something. It's like a really been around for a while. Anyway, this week, I have to admit, I'm not a regular watcher. So I don't know if they were introducing a Ben-Gvir character or if they just decided to have a song for a Ben-Gvir character. But I was watching this clip that was posted on Twitter, and they're singing a song, like first Bibi singing about he needs somebody else in order to get 61 seats and have a coalition. And then comes Ben-Gvir and he's singing. And suddenly I'm like, oh, this is Springtime for Hitler. This is the tune of Springtime for Hitler from The Producers, with Ben-Gvir in the role of Hitler. Now I have to say, like, they production wise and like fitting the words to the tune, they did a very good job, but I have mixed feelings on using Hitler of all people. I mean, there's no denying that Ben-Gvir is racist for sure.
Right.
But I initially laughed and then I was like, oh, I don't know.
I mean, you know, any comparison to Hitler is something that I'll always have an issue with, unless it's someone who's really committing mass genocide. But that should be unique in of itself, but it's definitely not Ben-Gvir, right? And I find him appalling. I think he's a Jewish version to an extent of white supremacists. That's kind of more what he's like, right? But he is racist, but he also is someone who has been approved by the Supreme Court of Israel to run in elections, and that's what we have. And he represents a portion of society, and he's going to get a ton of votes in these coming elections. A lot of first-time voters are going to vote for him. It's actually very concerning.
Yeah, I mean, when it seemed like he was going to run separate from Smotrich, like he was definitely passing the threshold on his own. It was Smotrich who was losing out from them being separate. Ben-Gvir himself was a shoo-in, which is, yeah, it is definitely concerning. I mean, it's definitely the sort of Overton window, like of what's a acceptable political discourse has moved. I mean, even in the past 2 years, 2-3 years, right? Like, we are going to get Ben-Gvir, and there's a good chance even that he'll be a minister.
Will he get a visa to the United States of America? This I was wondering the other day.
No, he won't.
He's a convicted criminal, right? So he has a criminal record here in Israel.
He has a history of being a member of what the U.S. considered a terrorist group. I think that in the last year or two, they actually took Koch off of their terrorist groups list.
They did about a year ago.
Yeah.
That's right.
Not because they think Koch is okay now. I think just because they don't see it as an active group. But when Michael Ben-Ari, who is also, you know, a disciple of Kahana, and unlike Ben-Gvir, actually learned from Rabbi Kahana himself. I think Ben-Gvir was too young to have done that. But Michael Ben-Ari was not allowed in the United States as a Knesset member.
Right. That'll be interesting if he's a minister.
But I've also heard from, let's say, senior sources, American sources involved in the U.S.-Israel relationship, that a government that includes Ben-Gvir will be, let's say, detrimental to smooth U.S.-Israel relationship and cooperation.
And if Bibi can only make a government with him, what does he do?
I think Bibi will do what he needs to do to survive.
Right. Okay. So we'll have to wait to see what happens. In the meantime, we can continue to protest it on social media and write about it and tweet and put up posts on Facebook.
For now.
For now, right. But if there's another round of public disturbances and riots throughout the country, we might not be able to do that if it's up to the police chief in this country, Kobi Shabtai, who said in an interview in Yedioth Ahronot that's coming out this weekend that next time there are riots like there were during the Guardian of Walls operation back in May 2021, he would try to shut down all of social media in the country. Now, let me just repeat that again. The police chief in the state of Israel, a country that is still a democracy, still being the main word here, wants to shut down social media during what could evolve into riots, because he wants us to be like China
or Iran. I mean, what I found deeply ironic and sad, really, that I think it was the day after those quotes from Shabtai came to light, Iran shut down its last social media that it allowed, which was Instagram. I was like, maybe Kobi Shabtai should take his inspiration from somewhere else.
Or maybe he should just go be a police chief somewhere else. Because if you want my opinion about this guy, and I've never met him, I don't know him, but he should have been kicked out and resigned or been fired. What is it now? 18 months ago, about when in April, a little less than 18 months ago, in April of 2021, there was the greatest civil disaster in this country at Meron on Lag BaOmer when 45 people were trampled to death. He was there at the scene as the police chief. He was responsible for the operations of that site. And he's now, there's a State Commission of Inquiry, which has actually sent him a letter of warning that he might be found responsible for this. But the fact that this man did not realize after 45 people died while he was watching that he needs to go home because he's a disaster and a failure, this does not surprise me in the least bit, that someone of this complete But I'm thinking, I don't know, for some reason I'm forgetting my English, but, you know, atimut, how would you translate atimut? He's just shut off from the world, right? And totally disconnected. would be able to say something as stupid as that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, and we, again, we've discussed it even recently, but this is the whole way that the Mehrone disaster has been dealt with is really like a travesty of justice.
Yeah. I want to finish, and because this is the podcast before Rosh Hashanah, so we have a great interview with Yael Leibowitz, who actually is a former teacher of yours, Lahav, right? And we talk about that in the interview. But Yael is a really amazing scholar and educator on Judaic studies. She got her master's degree from Columbia University. And she taught Tanakh where you had her as a teacher at the Upper School of Ramaz. And now she teaches at Matan Women's Institute and is writing a book about Ezra and Nehemiah. So we're going to have her and talk to her about Rosh Hashanah and what the meaning of the Chag is. And also like looking at the comparisons between the period of the return of the Jewish people led by Ezra, however many thousands of years ago that was, and the renewal and rebuilding of a Jewish state basically here to where we are now. But I do want to share one photo that I found to be possibly the image of the year from my perspective. And this was last week when Abdallah bin Zayed al-Nahyan, a prince, a member of the royal family from the United Arab Emirates, the foreign minister, the brother to the president and the crown prince, visited Israel for 5 days as foreign minister. But one photo that really stood out to me was when he went to Yad Vashem and laid a wreath in the Hall of the Names, or the Hall of Memory, as it's called, by the fire there, that is to memorialize the 6 million people who were killed in the Holocaust. And that image to me was just, it's told this amazing story of where we are as the state of Israel, right? And what the story of what's happening throughout the Middle East and what's happening in this region and what opportunities still lie before us and what we can still achieve, and how we can't miss these amazing opportunities, and how things have changed so much. And I know you saw that photo too, and you also thought that it was pretty remarkable.
And just to compare it, incredibly moving. I mean, and we should remember probably one of the most moving photos of the previous year was when Abdallah bin Zayed and Gavi Ashkenazi, then the foreign minister, went to the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. So, you know, I think he's really committed to this, and in a Middle East where too many people deny the Holocaust or are just ignorant of it, you know, it's just such an important and moving gesture. But we should remember that just a couple days, maybe even the day after, bin Zayed visited Yad Vashem, that Raisi, the president of Iran, said on 60 Minutes that, you know, people should be allowed to research because it's not so clear if the Holocaust really happened, right, or not, which is...
And it really, it just shows the difference between the forces of good and the forces of evil in the Middle East today. And I think that we as Israelis and as Jews have to really respect and appreciate and cherish this amazing relationship, but also opportunity that we have, and make sure that we don't ruin it. Because as we know, this is also possible.
It's possible, but are you worried that we're going to ruin it?
I think we're doing a decent job. I think we can do a little better. I think it's for another conversation.
Okay.
But I think there's some things that we can do a little better. But I think that it's a remarkable it was a remarkable image, and it fills me with hope on the eve of this Rosh Hashanah and this new Jewish year that we have good things to come, looking forward. So with that, Lahav, I wish you a Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
We've been running this podcast now for over a year. I hope our listeners are enjoying it. Wishing everyone a new year, a happy and healthy new year, and to you too, Lahav. And here's to Yael Leibowitz, our interview for this week. So it's great to be joined by Yael Leibowitz, who's a famed Jewish scholar, a teacher here in Israel at Matan Women's Institute, a frequent lecturer in North America and the United Kingdom. And Lahav, I think you and Yael have some history. You go a bit back.
Yes. Yael was also my teacher in high school, my Torah teacher.
Favorite. So, Yael, can you tell us the secrets? Like, was Lahav a good student?
All the
was
secrets.
She not a good student?
All kicked out of class every day. It was unbelievable.
It's a miracle she's made it this far. A
miracle. I
had two Torah teachers in high school, Yael, and then another woman, Becky Strapp, and they both like made Aliyah, and I reconnected with them in Israel, which is like, it's random, but it's nice. And I have other teachers who made Aliyah too. So I don't know. I guess it was
there was something in the water at the time.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Bushy Herzog, you know?
Exactly.
So Yael, great to have you with us. And we're talking to you ahead of Rosh Hashanah, which starts Sunday night, the new Jewish year. And what we thought was kind of like, what should people be thinking about when it comes to Rosh Hashanah? What does this holiday mean? Obviously, you know, dip the apple in the honey, all the different other customs, the simanim. There's a lot of prayer, a lot of time spent in synagogue and Beit Knesset. But when you think about it, where does it take you as you think about the new year that's coming?
Right. So yeah, listen, ritual is really, really important. You know, I talk about this with my students a lot. Ritual is what perpetuates our stories. So definitely dipping the apple in the simanim is really a big piece of it. You know, and then of course there's the issue of repentance and the issue of how do we think about that? What does that mean? And I think there's a lot of different approaches. One approach, which I actually came across in a completely different context, having nothing to do with Rosh Hashanah, but I think really ties in beautifully to this time of year. There's this really fascinating, I guess you could call it a genre of literature, of movies. It's sort of being taken more seriously now in academic circles in the field of history as well. And it's called Allohistory, which is, basically think of any cheesy Christmas movie where the guy is working too hard and his priorities are out of order and he gets hit on the head and wakes up in the morning surrounded by his loving family and he has the chance to, you know, to do it all over again, mm-hmm. right? So that's the cheesy version. But it, you know, it appears in, it's taken, you know, in history, when we study history, it's really a fascinating, I think, sort of intellectual exercise. And it's found actually, interestingly enough, in portions of Tanakh as well, where what you do really, it's sort of this hypothetical scenario where we imagine what history or what our reality would look like if there were an alternative ending. And you could take extreme examples, which most of the Allohistories do, which is, you know, what would the world look like if the Nazis had won World War II? What would our, you know, in American history, you can ask what would have happened if there were no Revolutionary War? What would have happened if Jesus were never born, right? What would the world look like without Christianity wholesale? So, you know, it manifests in really, really cool ways historically. And in Tanakh also, there are, you know, cases where the Nevi'im, for example, Yirmiyahu HaNavi, will imagine a hypothetical when he speaks about that little window after the destruction of the first temple, right before Gedaliah is murdered. And when he describes that period, he invokes all this language from his prophecies of consolation. And, you know, Ehud Ben Tzvi actually suggests that maybe that's a version of Allohistory, where the Navi is saying, you know, had you guys not messed up, had you not, you know, gotten into this infighting, had you not assassinated your own leader, who was your last hope, there could have been a completely alternate ending to your history. You know, so in the big sort of in the national and international pictures, it's something to think about. But I think on the individual level also, you know, as humans, we imagine that we make lots of different mistakes. But I think at the end of the day, we're always.
So it's a time to redo. It's like a time to press reset.
It's a time to, I guess to consider what we would be if we made different decisions, where the trajectory would end up. You know, I think we make the same mistake in different iterations in our personal life. So if we can imagine a mistake we made, we can't go back in time. But if we can imagine a mistake we made and then imagine an alternate ending, that sort of equips us for the next time we hit up against that parallel scenario, which I think is really sort of fascinating, you know, again, mental exercise for the process of tshuva. You know, I think there's really something to be said for that. You know, and then of course there's the, you know, there's the creation of the world theme, which we spend a lot of time thinking about on Rosh Hashanah. But I think there's more to it than just God created the world and we have to be scared because now he's judging us.
So that brings me to, we have a lot of Christian readers and listeners at the Jerusalem Post. And I think that the way like the Old Testament versus the New Testament is described or understood by a lot of Christians is that the God of the Old Testament is the sort of scary fire and brimstone one, whereas the New Correct. The New Testament is about forgiveness. But actually, we in the Jewish tradition, I mean, we put a lot of emphasis on forgiveness. This entire month of Elul is about praying for forgiveness. And of course, the holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And that's, you know, something that I think that people who are looking at Judaism from the outside completely overlook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, listen, I think it's something people looking from the outside, I think it's something that as modern people, you know, living in a predominantly, or at least in the Western world, a predominantly monotheistic world, also take as a given this notion that God can be merciful. You know, when the Torah was given, when we received the concept, the revolutionary concept of monotheism to begin with, you know, so I always say, you know, monotheism is not a quantity issue, it's a quality distinction, right? It's not just there's one God as opposed to 30 in the pantheon. It's that the God that we worship is not only, you know, omnipotent and omnipresent, but that the God that we worship embedded in this covenantal relationship we have with him is the opportunity for repentance, like you said. Embedded is the notion that one of God's, you know, characteristic features, one of his, you know, we call the 13 attributes is really revolves around this notion of mercy, which is really, it was certainly revolutionary in the ancient world. I think it's still in many ways, like you're saying, Lahav, revolutionary today. I think it's important in terms of our relationship with God. I think it's also critical in terms of how we think of ourselves. You know, the whole idea in monotheistic religions is we're supposed to imitate God. So, you know, are we as forgiving as we hope God will be in our relationship with him is, I think, another really important component of that issue as well.
Do you think, though, Yael, that people fully appreciate what Rosh Hashanah is? Because it seems to me like, you know, there's the people who go to synagogue and the people who go to temple, and you know, American synagogues, for example, are packed on the high holidays. Mm-hmm. Like you have your Jews who go for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and that's about it, right, throughout the year.
Right.
It's a lot of customs. It's a festival. You know, there are the people who spend 9 hours out of the day in prayer, and there are the people who go and want to get it over with after an hour and a half. Now, obviously, it's great that Judaism offers everyone. I'm, by the way, on the hour and a half side.
I was going to say, I just want to be clear.
I want to put that right out there. I mean, so it's great that Judaism offers everyone this kind of, you know, smorgasbord of different opportunities, but right. How to convey that in modern times? Like, it seems like it's kind of a clash, like the idea to spend so long in a synagogue, right, to listen to the shofar, all these things are like so distant from our modern lives.
Yeah, no, listen, there's no question. It feels almost, you know, anachronistic, right, in today's day and age where everything is so frenetic and so quick to sort of spend that many hours. But I think your question really dovetails a little bit with what Lahav was asking in terms of, you know, the issue of, you know, God as this strict, vengeful God, and we have to hope he forgives us. You know, I think in our modern day, I think it's more than that. I think it's more than just fearing, you know, the punishing, wrathful God. I think in our day and age, you know, for better and for worse, we have the luxury of sort of asking and re-asking the question all the time, you know, what is my purpose in life? Where do I belong? What am I contributing to this world? And I think that's really in many ways what Rosh Hashanah is about. Repentance is sort of a big umbrella word, but ultimately, you know, the creation of the world, when we talk about it, you know, it's not, we make the mistake of saying, creation ex nihilo, God, you know, created material form from this void. It's not just about a void. The creation, as it's understood in the Hebrew Bible, is what we call, you know, in fancy terminology, it's called a functional ontology, which just really basically means that it wasn't just about creation of material things. It was creation of things and giving them not just physical form, but giving them purpose. Right? Every time God looks and it says, and God saw that it was good, it wasn't, you know, a good, he's patting himself on the back that the birds look pretty. It was a sense that the very thing that God formed has a purpose in this universe, and the way that he created it is able to meet its purpose. You know, so I think humanity, ultimately, what we're asking on Rosh Hashanah is not just that God forgive us, but we're asking ourselves the question, you know, am I fulfilling my purpose in this world? What is my purpose? Have I gotten somehow, you know, distracted by all the background noise or by ego or by any of the other things that could sort of throw us off of our, of the map, you know, the road we're supposed to be on. And, you know, I think that's a big thing that we can spend time, you know, singing about, but thinking about also.
Maybe tell us a little bit about why you decided to write a book about Ezra and why do you think it resonates today?
Yeah, so I'm actually writing as part of Matan has a new program called Kitvuni, where they are generously really supporting women to be able to write books. So, you know, supporting financially, intellectually, practically. And Ezra Nehemia sort of spoke to me for a lot of reasons. But I think I'm not new anymore, but a relatively new Ola, there are just so many themes in Ezra Nehemia that really have modern resonances, that, you know, it's almost like, you know, someone says, you know, rebuild the state, the modern state of Israel.
Remind us, Yael, who Ezra and Nehemia were.
Sure. So Ezra and Nehemia were essentially the two leaders or two of the leaders of the what's called the restoration period in Jewish history, which is essentially the period following the Babylonian exile after Cyrus's decree in 539, where he basically says, you know, anyone who is exiled by the Babylonians, go back, rebuild your temples, you know, worship your local gods, basically restoring everything that had been taken from the Jewish community with the destruction of the first temple. And what Ezra Nehemia looks at is really how that happened and what that period of restoration looked like, what it means to rebuild a community, what it means to define yourself anew, to sort of draw from the past and also re-envision things because historical contingencies have shifted. So, you know, living in the state of Israel, which is I think still in many ways restoring itself, and in the process of restoration, the overlap is just, it's impossible to miss, and it's inspiring and it's thought provoking.
So it's interesting also because he comes back to the land of Israel with the people, mm-hmm. right, from Babylonia, right. and he restores laws that were destroyed after the first temple had been burned right. down, right? Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like the beginning of what would, I guess, turn into the new Commonwealth of Israel, right? Because eventually we would get Correct. Another temple, and you would have the period of the Jewish people in this land. But mm-hmm. what is, you know, looking at now, we also are back with a new government, a new Commonwealth.
Right. And
there were mistakes that Ezra then made also. That
Certainly.
It didn't work out, right? We didn't end up getting, the Jews didn't stay here forever. Right. They left again.
Right. Listen, there are certainly mistakes that were made. One of the things that's most that I think, you know, what I love most about the work of Ezra Nehemia, you know, as Jews, we sort of have this tendency to either idealize the past or envision this idealized utopian future. And then the now becomes this sort of, you know, liminal space where we're either waiting for, you know, what eventually becomes messianism, or we're imagining this high, you know, heyday of Ezra Nehemia is really very much not just focused on rebuilding despite the imperfections of its period, but it's also very open and very honest about some of the struggles and some of the conflicts that arose, you know, in the first temple period, you know, in the pre-exilic period, let's say. So to be a Jew means that you live within the geographical boundaries of the land and you follow the laws of the land, the laws of the king. And you know, you're considered a Jew, which is, you know, Ruth is the quintessential ger, because she moved physically to the land of Israel and said, your God is my God. Your rules are my rules. And once Ezra, you know, this is again just one example of some of the modern, you know, parallels. So once Ezra gets back, he understood that if he stuck to geographical definition, you know, the geographical boundaries as a defining feature of who is a Jew, then you're basically disenfranchising the majority of the Jewish population that still lived in Babylon and many, many Jews that still live down in Egypt. So Ezra had to redefine who is a Jew. He had to ask that perennial question, who is a Jew? What defines someone as a Jew? And he redefined it based on genealogy, and that raised a whole host of questions, which Ezra Nehemia wrestles with very openly in the book. You know, as soon as you're including some people, you're by definition excluding others, and vice versa. And you know, who is a Jew is one major question that was raised. The transition from oral to textual, you know, to literary culture was a big transition. How you know, there was a a small population of Jews back in Judea, but majority of the Jews lived outside the land. How do you maintain cohesion? How do you talk about shared interests as opposed to conflict of interests? All the issues that we struggle with in the modern state of Israel, you know, existed in the 5th and 4th centuries BCE. It's actually pretty wild to see how many of the issues really arise again. It's really pretty fascinating.
Bringing us full circle, I mean, we were talking about like alternate endings, allo history, and I think one of the lessons that you say you're going to bring about Ezra and Nehemiah is that there really are no perfect endings. That history is complicated. So, can you explain how that ties in?
Yeah. Listen, I think, you know, the history is complicated. I think it's something that Ezra and Nehemiah acknowledge in the sense that they understand that for every positive movement or for every, you know, for every positive legislation, there's always going to be unintended consequences. And what I love about Ezra and Nehemiah is the acknowledgement of those unintended consequences and paying attention to what that does. You know, it's sort of the opposite. I think we sometimes get so caught up in our vision or our agendas that we forget what's outside of that. And I think the work of Ezra and Nehemiah really in a very distinctive way never gets lost. Or never ignores those unintended consequences. And I think it addresses topics head on, you know, sort of like little known fact. There was a temple in Egypt where Jews were worshiping. It was built before the Second Temple was born, and then it existed really through a very good part of the Second Temple period, right? So the question is, how did the Jews in Egypt see Judea, the province of Judea? Was Israel considered the center or was it the periphery of their religious life? Those are questions that existed in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, and they're ongoing. The question of center and periphery, the question of what do you do if you're dependent economically on foreign powers, the question, all of these are questions that I think don't have perfect endings, but I think the assumption that the Jewish community in Israel and the diaspora community need to be able to find common ground and need to be able to articulate what those shared interests are and not let the conflicting interests get in the way of that or overshadow the shared interests. I think the sense that there needs to be cohesion within the Jewish community, you know, internally and also more broadly, it's not easy. Ezra Nehemiah is very clear about the fact that none of those are easy scenarios, but that we have to keep working to make sure, you know, as Yaakov, as you mentioned, that we don't end up with a failed third commonwealth. Because, you know, history has shown that that's always a...
And heading into our fifth election, that's something definitely to think about ahead of this Rosh Hashanah. Yeah. So bringing it back to politics,
yes, always.
That is our bread and butter. But Yael Leibowitz, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And have a Shana Tova.
Thank you to everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. As always, if you enjoyed it, please send to your friends and family. We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the other major podcast platforms. We also want to wish everyone a Shana Tova, a Happy New Year, a Sweet New Year, and may you be inscribed in the Book of Life.